Before we begin though, I'd just like to show our appreciation and thank the Moment Centenary Project for sponsoring this event, and welcome John O'Keefe and Chris Bly, who are here tonight from the project. So thank you. And also a big thank you to the Arts Council England, as always, sincerely thanking them for their sponsorship and support of the festival as a whole. So I'd like to introduce the performers for tonight. Jan Long was educated in Africa, the Far East, and in the UK. Living and working abroad inspired her love of culture and diversity, and various civil service postings in the UK and overseas developed her passion for history, particularly in relation to strong women such as Gertrude Bell, on whom Jan is an authority. Jan's research into local poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning has resulted in her essay, Fair Play or Foul, exploring whether or not Robert Browning expedited the demise of his wife. Sarah Jane Arbery was born in Exeter and lives in Ledbury. A writer, performer and workshop facilitator, Sarah Jane has been involved in the production and promotion of creative writing and live literature for over 25 years. She has collaborated with organisations including the Arts Council, the BBC, Oxford University Press and Blood Axe Books. She was the director of Voices Off, the fringe programme at Cheltenham Literature Festival, for 11 years and was appointed the first writer in residence for Herefordshire. And we also have Sophie Challender, who will be singing tonight. Sophie is from Dymock and attends Pates Grammar School in Cheltenham, where she's very involved with music and drama. She plays the piano and the oboe. She's a member of Ledbury Amateur Dramatic Society, and she's currently in three plays and has indeed just come from directing a play with 120 11 to 15 year olds. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jan Long, Sarah Jane Arbery, and Sophie Challender. Thank you.
It's good of you to ask me, sir, to tell you how I spend my day. Well, in the coal black tunnel, sir, I hurry coves to earn my pay. The coves are full of coal, kind sir. I push them with my hands and head. It isn't ladylike, but sir, you've got to earn your daily bread. I push them with my hands and head, and so my hair gets worn away. You see this baldy patch I've got, it shames me like I just can't say. A lady's hands are lily white, but mine are full of cuts and sex. And since I'm pushing all the time, I've great big muscles on my legs. I try to be respectable, but sir, the shame, God save my soul. I work with naked, sweating men who curse and swear and chew the coal. The sight, the smell, the sound, kind sir, not even God and sense me shame. I say my prayers, but what's the use? Tomorrow will be just the same. Now sometimes, sir, I don't feel well. My stomach's sick, my head it aches. I've got to hurry best I can. My knees feel weak, my back near breaks. And then I'm slow, and then I'm scared. These naked men will batter me. They can't be blamed for if I'm slow. their families will starve, you see. All the lads, they laugh at me, and so the mirror tells me why. Pale and dirty, can't look nice, it doesn't matter how I try. Great big muscles on my legs, baldy patch upon my head. Ladies, sir, oh no, not me, I should have been a boy instead. I praise your good intentions, sir. I love your kind and gentle heart. But now it's 1842, and you and me, we're miles apart. 100 years or more will pass before we're walking side by side. But please accept my grateful thanks. But please accept my grateful thanks.
Everybody, and thank you for coming on this very warm night. I know you'd all rather be watering your garden. Certainly I would, but there you go. And thank you so much to Sophie. It takes a lot of courage to get up and sing complete with just your own voice and no accompaniment, so well done. And if you have programs, you'll see that that song is actually taken from evidence given by a girl, Patience Kershaw, to an investigation into women and children having to work down the mines, and that did eventually change, thank heavens. And that's part of why we're here tonight. So let's start. I have to thank John O'Keefe and Chris Bly and all the other of the army of the moment who should be dotted about, and to the Poetry Festival for giving us the opportunity to be talking to you. Sarah Jane is my beautiful assistant, and she's the one who's going to do the poems, and she looks so gorgeous, don't you?
Well, likewise, Jane.
Oh, sure. Okay, so let's start. In the 7th century, St. Cyneburga was appointed abbess to the joint monastery of Gloucester, ruling both the monks and the nuns. And yet it took another 1,400 years for another woman to be in charge of the cathedral in Gloucester. Well done, Bishop Rachel. It's a testament to the slow progress towards equality, which begs the question, why, when history is so rich with powerful women, do we find Letitia Elizabeth Landon in her poem, The Marriage Vow, suggesting that death is preferable to marriage?
The altar, 'tis of death. For there are laid the sacrifice of all youth's sweetest hopes. It is a dreadful thing for woman's lip to swear the heart away. Yet know that heart annuls the vow while speaking and shrinks back from the dark future that it dares not face. The service read above the open grave is far less terrible than that which seals the vow that binds the victim, not the will, for in the grave is rest.
So for most part of the 19th century, the legal status of women was little better than that of a slave. John Stuart Mill spoke of this in his 1869 book, The Subjection of Women.
On marriage, a woman ceased to be a person in her own right and became a mere extension of her husband. She was unable to own property, even that she brought to the marriage. In a sense, she was unable to control her life. Even divorce was all but impossible, as it required a special act of Parliament.
So in short, a married woman was her husband's chattel, her person, wealth and possessions being his to dispose of as he saw fit. Worse still, the law could force her to return to an abusive spouse, and if the marriage broke down completely, the children were automatically granted to the father. There's a worrying echo of this state of affairs right through to the present day. September 2016, Parliament was debating the way the law impacts on victims. It was universally accepted that the vast majority of such victims of abuse were women. It's also widely accepted that the domestic violence begets traumatised children, many of whom go on to be abusers themselves, or are precipitated into antisocial behaviour and even crime. Yet, come the debate in Parliament, there were no more than 24 MPs, all but 4 were women, in the chamber. And yet every MP tells a victim seeking their help. Every MP knows how pernicious the effects are, but despite this, less than 4% thought it was an issue worthy of their time. Granted, time is limited, but it's hard to escape the conclusion that Parliament is still dominated by men who have little time for or insight into the societal deficit faced by women. This is all the more concerning when considered against the repeated stories of women in politics being subjected to verbal and physical abuse. Harriet Harman said in Parliament that it was a long way to go. She cited the example of the MP Sir Nicola Soames, grandson of Winston Churchill, who had to apologise to an SNP member, Tasmin Ahmed Sheikh, for making woof, woof, woof noises when she was speaking. Yes, indeed. Millard Lowe, in 1916, wrote,
"In the fullness of time, the empty scales of justice crave balance. Waning reconciliation awaits full emancipation. As the pale sun fades, frail freedom flashes upon the horizon."
And Rudyard Kipling famously wrote,
"The silliest woman can manage a clever man, but it needs a very clever woman to manage a fool."
So, girls, what are you managing today? 100 years later, the Select Committee report has uncovered the scale and impact of sexual harassment and sexual violence in schools across England, which must be acted upon urgently. The evidence gathered paints a concerning picture. Harassment and abuse of girls being accepted as daily life, children of primary school age learning about sex and relationships through hardcore pornography, teachers accepting that sexual harassment is just banter. Unbelievable. And parents are struggling to know how they can best support their children. Despite this evidence, existing legislation, the government has no coherent plan to ensure schools tackle the cause or consequence of abuse, harassment and sexual violence. So let's not forget the cringeworthy reportage of David Davis. You all know who he is, of course. David Davis in the Strangers Bar in the House of Commons is euphoric because of the vote that allows Brexit. We're all going ahead with Brexit. And he was, I think, a little bit tipsy. And he made a big mistake. He decided to give Diane Abbott a kiss and an embrace. But the Shadow Home Secretary was not amused and no uncertain terms told him to off. It's in all the papers if you want to look back. Christina Georgina Rossetti expressed women's sorrows of an unequal life.
"It's a weary life, it is," she said, "doubly blank in a woman's lot. I wish and I wish I were a man, or better than any being were not, were nothing at all in all the world, not a body and not a soul, not so much as a grain of dust or a drop of water from pole to pole. Still the world would wag on the same. Still the seasons go and come. Blossoms bloom as in days of old. Cherries ripen and wild bees hum. None would miss me in all the world. How much less would care or weep? I should be nothing, while all the rest would wake and weary and fall asleep."
And perhaps this poem by Becca Rhodes might fire your imagination.
"Every bruise you gave me has become a battle shield. Every scar you gave me has regenerated stronger skin. You can't touch me now. Every bone broken by you has healed. Every tear shed for you has long since dried. You can't reach me now. I'm peaceful. I've stopped the war. You can't hurt me anymore.
So, back to Victorian times, where there was no ambiguity about the relative rights and responsibilities of the sexes. It may be a little fanciful to suggest this, but it's more than possible that a minor theft became the catalyst which propelled one of the great suffragists into a lifelong campaign for female equality and the vote. Elizabeth Garrett Fawcett had just been married a short time. She was 20, and in 1867 she went out to do some shopping. Her purse containing a few coins was stolen by a pickpocket, and when the miscreant came to trial, he was charged by the police for stealing from the person of Millicent Fawcett a purse containing £1, 18 shillings and sixpence, the property of Henry Fawcett. So the Married Woman's Property Act, after much debate, of 1870, was superseded by 82 and then 83, and granted women not only the right to own property, but also to own any income earned within the marriage. Centuries of discrimination were overturned, and a married woman at last had the same right as one who was single. It might appear to you that this landmark legislation made further campaigning unnecessary. Mm-mm, far from it. Pandora's box had been opened. The acts were quite clear, and the law that could be changed, like Oliver Twist, the supporters took it as encouragement that they would ask for more. Our local poet, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, repeatedly criticises women's secondary role in society, the ways in which the limitations and institution of marriage suppresses them, and the idea that love and sexual relations are often grounded in problematic and often brutal power games. Betrayal, duplicity and loss are dominant themes in her poems, which often see the woman silenced or dead at the end. Conventional society's expectations are entrapping and potentially deadly. By the 1840s, Elizabeth celebrates strong women, and in her words, in Lady Geraldine's Courtship, she depicts the Lady Geraldine as a woman who rejects the image of female passivity, embodies in the statute of Silent in the Wood and her estate. Instead, Geraldine asserts independence, and as initiates a cross-class relationship with the low-born poet Bertram. And the character of Bertram says,
"There's a lady, an earl's daughter. She is proud and she is noble. And she treads the crimson carpet and she breathes the perfumed air. She has halls among the woodlands. She has castles by the breakers. She has farms and she has manors. She can threaten and command, and the palpitating engines snort in steam across her acres. She has voters in the commons, she has lovers in the palace, and of all the fair court ladies, few have jewels half as fine. Oft the prince has named her beauty 'twixt the red wine and the chalice. Oh, and what was I to love her? My beloved Geraldine."
And in her most famous epic poem, Aurora Leigh, she's explicit about the condescending attitude shown to women writers when she writes witheringly,
"You never can be satisfied with praise which men give women when they judge a book not as mere work, but as mere woman's work. Expressing the comparative respect, which means the absolute scorn. Oh, excellent! What grace! What facile turns! What fluent sweeps! What delicate discernment! Almost thought! The book does honour to the sex we hold. Among our female authors we make room for this fair writer, and congratulate the country that produces in these times such women competent to spell."
Today, when we think about the struggle to gain votes for women, our minds almost automatically turn to the suffragettes and Emmeline Pankhurst. But in fact, there were two groups of women, and the suffragists were one of them, and the suffragettes were the other. And under the umbrella of the National Union of Women's Suffrage, the suffragists maintained a high level of membership throughout the struggle. Indeed, quite a number of suffragettes defected to them in protest when the levels of civil disobedience, militancy, and more became unacceptable. Despite these losses, violent and criminal acts as well as civil disobedience characterized the suffragette movement in the years leading up to the First World War. But in 1909, the Men's League for Women's Suffrage published a list of prominent men who were in favour of suffragettes and suffrage. They included 83 former government ministers, church leaders, high-ranking army and navy officers, academics, writers including Ian Forster, Thomas Hardy, H.G. Wells, Arthur Pinero, and our own poet, John Masefield. And by 1910, there were branches of the Men's League all over Britain. So it's hard for us to comprehend the social mores of that time, but the movement existed to fight entrenched Victorian values and attitudes. Women had no place in politics, were not allowed to vote, and the idea that they might become a member of parliament would have been laughed at. It was assumed that they would be taken care of by their husbands, who naturally would expect to take responsibility for political matters within the family. A woman's role in Victorian and Edwardian Britain may be best summed up by Hitler's infamous aphorism, Kinder, Küche, Kirche, children, kitchen, church. How, went the cry all over the land from all the men in the class, different classes, can women either need the vote or have the capacity to use it? In 1620, Thomas Campion scathingly writes,
"Lost is our freedom when we submit to women so. Why do we need them when in their best they work our woe?"
And women fared no better with W.S. Gilbert, who wrote,
"In all the woes that curse our race, there's always a lady in the case."
And mockingly, this 2003 poem by Carolyn Kaiser is entitled Fearful Women. And really, it gives the perception that it's always the woman's fault.
Slender arms, braceleted and white and bare. Arms so lovely, ours so rare. Arms of Helen's, in whose name Greeks slaughtered Trojans. Helen was to blame. Escape nanny, call her, for wars for turf and profit don't sound glamorous enough. Old Zeus refused to take the rap. It's not his name in big print on the map. But let's go back to the beginning, when sinners didn't know they were sinning. He, one rib short. She lived to rue it, when Adam said to God, "She made me do it." Eve learned that knowledge was a dangerous thing for her. No end of trouble would it bring. So, an educated woman is a danger. Lock up your mate, keep a submissive stranger, like Darby's Joan, content with church and kinder. Not like that sainted Joan, burnt to a cinder. Whether we wield a sceptre or a mop, it's clear men fear that we may get on top.
Nonetheless, in a somewhat perverse rebuttal of this attitude, women did obtain the right to vote in some council elections as early as 1888. The changes that produced the female emancipation movement had been in train for some time. And the Industrial Revolution and the mills and factories it spawned meant that the first time women met in large groups, they could discuss political and social issues. In parallel, the rise of the trade union influence and the nascent Labour Party were challenging the established order. Organised campaigns for women's suffrage started around 1866. Parliament discussed the reform in 1867. And during the debate, John Stuart Mill proposed an amendment that would have given women the same voting rights as men. The proposal was defeated by 104 no votes to only 73 yes. But it's not the defeat that's surprising and important. It's the yes votes that gave impetus to the movement. Many of the male MPs who voted for suffrage would have been roundly mocked by their peers and by the majority of the constituents. They were the brave vanguard of modern man. And despite this, it's still seen as acceptable to mock and sneer at women's aspirations. In the 1880s, Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera of Princess Ida talks of...
A woman's college? Maddest folly going! What can a girl learn within its walls ever be worth knowing?
And in the body of the song which Gilbert wrote...
They intend to send a wire to the moon, and they'll set the Thames on fire very soon, very soon. They've a firmly rooted notion they can cross the polar ocean. They've a plan, they've a plan. They'll even find perpetual motion if they can, if they can. Each newly joined aspirant to this clan, must repudiate the tyrant known as man, known as man. So the circle they shall square it, and their fashion shall forswear it, and do without their fellow man if they can, if they can.
Feminism as a movement is not, as many believe, a product of the latter half of the 20th century. In the 19th century, feminists referred to it as the cause, which is your title for this evening. And over time, there's a fine for that, by the way. And over time, and through disagreements on tactics and aims, this developed into two quite separate wings. The branch was one of the National Women's Union of Suffragist Societies, and the other was the Suffragettes Union. So the union was created in 1897 from various local societies by the formidable Millicent Fawcett, her of the stolen purse. Quite apart from leading the USS from 1897, her passion for equality saw her take a leading role in founding Newnham College in Cambridge. She was also a lifelong campaigner for workers' rights and fighting laws, where dual standards were applied in respect of men and women. Unlike the suffragettes, her drive was to obtain votes for property-owning middle-class women. The union ethos was peaceful means and non-violent tactics. She posited that if the movement was seen to be intelligent, law-abiding and respectful, women would prove themselves responsible enough to take a full part in politics. The schism between the suffragist and the suffragette is best summed up by Millicent herself.
I can never feel that setting fire to houses, churches and letterboxes and destroying valuable pictures really helps to convince people that women ought to be enfranchised.
The argument between direct and indirect and direction pithily argued. The NUWSS was almost exclusively middle class. Its more radical members recognised that the movement needed the support of working class women. The cause had the effect of connecting women across social boundaries and providing an identity. Today we would call it a brand in which they could all subscribe. Millicent Fawcett is remembered for many of her quotes, not just on suffrage, but on workers' rights and the economy. Perhaps this message is for us today.
There are many excuses made for the person who made the mistake of confounding money and wealth. Like many others, they mistook the sign for the thing signified.
So those wanting to avoid yet another banking crisis should perhaps take note. And while talking of banks, let's come up to date and consider the role of women in banking. You go to any retail branch of a bank, and the chances are that it'll be a woman behind the counter. If, however, you go to a trading floor, it will likely to be wall-to-wall testosterone. Think about it, the cornerstone of our economy, and it's more likely they're men who'll run the show. Worse still, as several recent cases have shown, the age-old sexual bias not only limits women's chances of rising to the top, but connives at harassment and low-level sexual abuse. It is perhaps not too far-fetched to wonder whether the absence of senior women meant that the dizzy accumulation of debt that characterised the banking crisis might have been challenged and even avoided had women been in charge. This poem by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, written around 1911, is a witty riposte to those who opposed enfranchisement.
When the woman's suffrage argument first stood upon its legs, they answered it with cabbages. They answered it with eggs. They answered it with ridicule. They answered it with scorn. They thought it a monstrosity that should never have been born. When the woman's suffrage argument grew vigorous and wise, and was not to be answered by these opposite replies, they turned their opposition into reasoning severe upon the limitations of our God-appointed sphere. We were told of disabilities, a long array of these, till one could think that womanhood was merely a disease, and the maternal sacrifice was added to the plan of the various sacrifices we have always made to man. Religionists and scientists in amity and bliss, however else they disagreed, could all agree on this. And the gist of all their discourse, when you got down to it, was we could not have the ballot because we were not fit. They would not hear the reason. They would not fairly yield. They would not own their arguments were beaten in the field. But time passed on, and some way, we need not ask them how, whatever ails those arguments, we do not hear them now. You may talk of suffrage now with an educated man, and he agrees with all you say as sweetly as he can. 'Twould be better for us all, of course, if womanhood was free. But the women do not want it, and so it must not be. Do we ask to be forbidden from all the trades that pay? Did we claim the lower wages for a man's full work today? Have we petitioned for the laws wherein our shame is shown, that not a woman's child nor her own body is her own? What women want has never been a strongly acting cause. When woman has been wronged by man in churches, customs, laws, why should he find this preference so largely in his way, when he himself admits the right of what we ask today?
The term suffragette was coined by Daily Mail journalist Charles Hands. Well, you all believe the Daily Mail, don't you? And it was meant as a term of derision, but it spectacularly backfired on him. You can still find posters where the word is written. And it was Emmeline Pankhurst, who was a leading member of the Manchester suffrage group. As respectable gradualist and middle-class tactics failed to produce results, her patience gave out. And in 1903, she set up a separate society for the suffragettes. That role was taken seriously, underreported, and resulted in being underestimated because Manchester was cottonopolis. And in the surrounding towns, the mill was the principal employer of men, women, and children, and the critical mass for social change. When it came, it worked on the dark satanic mills. Emily knew this. Actively recruited in the mills, and history tends to focus on the high profile, and it is with the suffragettes, Emmeline believed, an active organisation amongst young women, particularly the working classes, would gain the attention of Parliament. But what form of active organisation should take became an argument and occupied several years. In 1907, Emmeline and her daughter Christabel had a major falling out with one of the other unions. It didn't matter because they all wanted the same end. And this split meant that Emmeline and her supporters were effectively dominating the workings and the strategy of the union. But the suffragettes' motto, deeds, not words, came to define the movement from 1911 onwards. And this was the movement where law-breaking, violence, including the bombing of Lloyd George's house, hunger strikes, as well as large disruptive public meetings, were the bread and butter of the suffrage campaign. Now, because it's all hot in here, bit of audience participation. I think you've got in front of you a song to the tune of Auld Lang Syne. Sophie, do you want to lead us in this? No, she says no. Okay. Well, I can't sing, so bear with me. Are you any better?
No.
Okay. Have you got it?
No.
Very well. Right. Who wants to start? It's called Keep Women in Their Sphere. Okay. And it's... I have a neighbour, one of those not very hard to find, who know it all without debate and never change their mind. I asked him what of women's rights, he said in tone severe, my mind on that is all made up, keep woman in her sphere. I saw a man in tattered garb forth from the grog shop come. He squandered all his cash for drink and starved his wife at home. I asked him, should not women vote? He answered with a sneer, I've taught my wife to know her place, keep woman in her sphere. I met an earnest, thoughtful man not many days ago, deep all human law, the honest truth to know. I asked him what of woman's cause, the answer came sincere, her rights are just the same as mine, let woman choose her sphere.
Well done, all of you. Give yourselves a hand. That's excellent. Okay, you can relax again now for a moment while I find my page. Ah, yes, here we are. So, despite the different styles, the two unions work together and increased membership around the country. It was amazing because they had 20,000 people having a newsletter called Votes for Women. So you compare this with today, the communication benefits with social media confer, but there's no central driving force. This is what women's issues are, a series of campaigns or stories that the newspapers love to parody, rather than a robust and constant reminder that women have an equal place in all parts of society. We all know of the Derby incident where on June 8th, 1913, Emily Davidson spectacularly threw herself in front of the horses. There were several bombings as well as famous plate glass day when groups around the country smashed shop windows. And here we have a little bit of... And even better than that, listen to this. Anybody remember Nick Lowe? Anyway, that's enough of that. Many suffragettes were imprisoned, and some of whom, including Emmeline Pankhurst, went on hunger strike. That was a cruel act because what the brutal regime did in prison was when a woman went on hunger strike and became ill, she was released until she got better, and then she was rearrested and put back in prison. And they called this the Cat and Mouse Act for the way they were toying with women. 1913 became the high water line for the movement and is marked by a tightly organised march, nationwide march. It started at Land's End on 19th June and finished in Hyde Park. The march stopped at Corsham in Wiltshire, and all the marchers were met by a warm welcome as well as tea and cakes. What happened after that reveals the depth of feeling aroused by the march, or pilgrimage, as the protesters preferred to call it. The Gloucestershire contingent met up in the main street at Marlborough, and the reception was worse than hostile. It is extraordinary, therefore, that our great British heroine, Gertrude Bell, was anti-suffrage. But she did eventually change her mind when her magnificent work for Iraq was in danger of not being taken seriously because she was a woman. And in 1920, she produced a white paper on the government
of Iraq, and was exasperated when her peers seemed more interested in its author than in the contents, and she scathingly wrote,
"The general line taken by the press seems to be that it's remarkable that a dog should be able to stand up on its hind legs at all, i.e. a female write a white paper."
But it's a sign that the movement was winning its argument when Lloyd George, no less, in a speech at the Swindon Suffragette Society in October 1913, declared,
"The pilgrimage was one of the cleverest political moves to have been organised in recent times, because it was a dramatic way of catching the public attention, but in a lawful and peaceful way."
So, but from the classroom onwards, we all think of the World War I poets as being men. This is an opportunity to correct that imbalance. This, which Sarah Jane's going to read from us, is from Margaret Postgate Cole's poem, The Falling Leaves, and you will find a beautiful lament for the wholesale sacrifice of youth that stands with the best.
"Today, as I rode by, I saw the brown leaves dropping from their tree in a still afternoon, when no wind whirled them whistling to the sky, but thickly, silently they fell, like snowflakes wiping out the noon, and wandered slowly thence, for thinking of a gallant multitude which now all withering lay, slain by no wind of age or pestilence, but in their beauty strewed, like snowflakes falling on the Flemish clay."
The suffragists and the suffragettes both scaled back their activities because of the war, and they offered to help at the front. This offer was treated in a patronising manner with lots of comments along the lines of, "How can women possibly expect to be able to do men's work?" However, in 1915, that position changed dramatically. Far from being over by Christmas, the war dragged on and on and on, and more volunteers from factories and fields left to go to the front. The pressure on the labour market could no longer be ignored, and hundreds and thousands of women were sucked into the key industries, particularly manufacturing and agriculture. They worked as conductors on buses. Not the drivers, you notice, just the conductors. But many of the girls did go to the front to drive vehicles, ambulances for the troops, and were seen as increasingly in demand. The need for nurses and ancillary staff in hospitals rose sharply, and a number of middle and upper class girls, who would have been in nice, comfortable surroundings, were suddenly into real life. Their social bubble of their peacetime existence was gone. And an interesting outcome of this shift in the labour market was the feminisation of secretaries. Okay, so prior to the war, women worked in service, and it was a catch-all phrase for maids, cooks, governesses and nannies in the homes of the wealthy. And one of the lasting consequences of the war, that this eroded their ranks and made them post-war a scarce and much more expensive commodity. After all, who wants to curtsy to their master when they could be independent and self-sufficient? Some 100,000 agricultural workers entered the forces, and they were replaced by only 23,000 women. Does that mean one woman could do four men's jobs? No, it doesn't. This is a somewhat conservative estimate, since it does not include the many who made casual arrangements. But it was, in fact, the POWs, 30,000 Germans and more, who were working on the land by 1918. Children were also volunteered, and the employment law breaches were sanctioned by the government. The suffrage societies arranged for their members to be volunteered into the Women's Land Army. And locally, we had Phyllis Davis. And Phyllis, who lived in Dimmock, became a Land Army girl. She was a diminutive figure, and at the start of the war, she worked in John Lewis. I heard a giggle up there. He knows who we mean. She worked in John Lewis on the beauty counter because her long red fingernails and her pretty good looks made her natural for that role. But she did volunteer, and what a transition from tending the hands of the rich to holding on to a ton of Shire horse. She was so small that the horse's bit was the limit of her reach. And if you go to the site of the Moment Press, you can listen to some of these conversations. So the universal suffrage demonstrated the movement and the support in Parliament was on the rise. Certainly women had achieved a credible and positive identity, a significant outcome of their efforts. And Lloyd George, who proved pro-suffrage, said in this wonderful speech,
"I want to bear testimony to the tremendous part which women have played in this vital epoch in human history. They have not only borne their burden of sorrow and separation with unflinching fortitude and patience, they have assumed an enormous share of the burdens necessary to the practical conduct of the war. If it had not been for the splendid manner in which the women came forward to work in hospitals, in munition factories, on the land, in administrative offices of all kinds, and in war work behind the lines, often in daily danger of their lives, Great Britain and, as I believe, all the Allies would have been unable to withstand the enemy. For this service, humanity owes them unbounded gratitude. In the past, I have heard it said that women were not fit for the vote because they would be weak when it came to understanding the issues and bearing the strains of a great war. My recent experiences of meeting women in every role has confirmed me in the conviction that the women there understand perfectly what is at stake in this war. I believe that they recognise as clearly as any that there can be no peace, no progress, no happiness in the world so long as the monster of militarism is able to stalk unbridled and unashamed among the weaker peoples. My message is this. Well done. Carry on. You are helping to create a new earth for yourselves and for your children, and your inspirational spirit is typical of the women in Great Britain."
Wow. Jolly good. So before leaving the war, we must just mention Rotherwas. Rotherwas was a munitions factory, and there we had the Canary Girls. And they were called that because they packed munitions, the shells, with TNT. I've tried to say the real word for TNT. Can anybody say it? It's something like... Do you know I said that without moving my lips? Who said that? Put your hand up, who said it? Well done, that's absolutely right, because I've written it out and I still can't say it. Anyway, it's TNT, and it sent their skin yellow. But Lloyd George met them and gave them, as you heard from Sarah Jane, congratulations. Let's move on from the war in one way, because we need to honour another campaigner, and that was Vera Brittain. Vera Brittain wrote many, many things. One of my favourites of hers is Women at Oxford. Get it, it's great. She published a poem in memory of her fiancé, Roland Aubrey Layton, who was killed by a sniper. This is a potent reminder that the victims of war extended beyond the battlefield. Vera suffered, as did hundreds and thousands of women, for the loss of love and a future they hoped for. Grieving wife, mother, or fiancé, Sarah Jane will read these words now.
"Perhaps someday the sun will shine again, and I shall see that still the skies are blue, and feel once more I do not live in vain, although bereft of you. Perhaps the golden meadows at my feet will make the sunny hours of spring seem gay, and I shall find the white may blossoms sweet, though you have passed away. Perhaps the summer woods will shimmer bright, and crimson roses once again be fair, and autumn harvest fields a rich delight, although you are not there. Perhaps some day I shall not shrink in pain to see the passing of the dying year, and listen to Christmas songs again, although you cannot hear. But though kind time may many joys renew, there is one greatest joy I shall not know again, because my heart, for loss of you, was broken long ago."
There's a lot of pressure to erase women and ease them out of their new found roles in the workplace and return to the status quo. Pressure that was intensified by deepening economic woes and an utter failure for the land fit for heroes, which was promised. It is surprising, then, that in 1917, Alice Woodruff, I can't even read my writing, but Alice, she's in the book at the back, was accused of trying to poison a dart that would be fired at Lloyd George. She was put in prison, but later released. The suffrage movement continued its own campaign, but moved away from confrontational because they realised they were getting the vote. This is really important because we all know that Nancy Astor was the first to sit, winning a by-election in Plymouth for the Tories. But she was not, however, the first to be elected. That honour goes to Constance Markievicz, who was chosen and elected for Sinn Féin. So Gerry Adams was not the first Republican to refuse to take his seat in the House. Victory finally came in 1928 when on the 2nd of July the Representation of the People Equal Franchise Act received royal assent. Millicent Fawcett, she of the stolen purse, you remember, still active in the Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, attended Parliament to witness the vote. Passed by a Tory government with little opposition, her moving diary entry for that day is as succinct as it is amazing.
It is almost exactly 61 years ago since I heard John Stuart Mill introduce his suffrage amendment to the Reform Bill on the 20th of May, 1867. So I have had the extraordinary good luck in having seen the struggle from the beginning.
Has the landmark moment in July 1928 led to equality and the kind of social justice sought by Millicent Fawcett and Emmeline Pankhurst? You may be the judge of that. Here are a few food for thought observations, and we'll start with something penned in 1792 by Robert Burns, but may well apply today.
While Europe's eye is fixed on mighty things, the fate of empires and the fall of kings, while quacks of state must each produce his plan, and even children lisp the rights of man, amid this mighty fuss, just let me mention, the rights of woman merit some attention. Now, thank our stars, those Gothic times are fled. Now, well-bred men, and you are all well-bred, most justly think, and we are much the gainers, such conduct neither spirit, wit, nor manners. But truce with kings, and truce with constitutions, with bloody armaments and revolutions. Let majesty your first attention summon. Ah, ah, ça ira, the majesty of woman.
So where does the power lie? Well, only 29% of MPs are women. Only 22% of members of the House of Lords are women. Less than 10% of the directors of the top 100 companies on the FTSE are women. And then there is the social burden. Women are routinely sexually abused, groped, fondled and subjected to sexist remarks and denigration because of their sex. This routine abuse in the workplace, including in the House of Commons and other public institutions, is still excused as banter and a bit of fun. And those who protest are caricatured as politically correct or bra-burning left-wing feministas, the inference clearly being that they, the victims, are somehow the problem. This tacit acceptance of discrimination legitimizes the activity of trolls who threaten to rape or murder women who speak out. And remember the case of Stella Creasy, who received terrifying threats from the idiot troll Peter Nunn simply because she supported Caroline Criado Perez's suggestion of having Jane Austen on the £10 banknote. Domestic violence, mainly perpetrated against women, has been largely ignored, and the number of single mothers has seen a steady rise. So let's go right back to the beginning. And women's property rights. It is by no means uncommon, even today, for the household finances to be managed by the man. And I know of middle class friends who grant their wives an allowance. You be the judge of where we are today. And even remember, just today on Woman's Hour, there was an article about Google. Google decided they can't afford to pay the women as much as they can the men, and it was going to cost them £100,000 to look at the pay scales. So one wag wrote on the website, well, you know, if you employed women to do this work, it would only cost you £75,000. Now I'm going to hand this on to Sarah Jane, because we've got a little bit of fun, because we're almost at the end. And this is going to be my quick change routine. Right, Sarah Jane, ready?
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Right, I'm reading it now.
Okay.
So they were cursed and called bitches, ostracised and seen as witches. So they joined the pioneers, but still endured the constant jeers. So they were beaten till they bled, and learned that Emily was dead. So they embarked on greater clashes, wearing bowler hats and sashes. So at last the deed was done. Votes for women. They had won.
Thank you, sir. So I think we're about 3 minutes to go. I want to say thank you again to all of you for coming and being such a great audience and joining in so well. And the final word, because Sarah Jane is one of these women who loves the final word, and this is the...
she does. That's news to me, Jan.
And this is the final verse of Maya Angelou's poem, Phenomenal Woman.
Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care. 'Cause I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's me.
Really? Thank you very much.